to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kehan. Today we'll discuss the article by Konchosh et al. Titled, Diastolic Dysfunction in Pre-Diabetic Male Rats, Role of Mitochondrial Oxidative Stress. This article published online October 1st, 2016. Joining me today are consulting editor Michael Wolin, lead author Zoltan Gieritz, and content expert Hemal Patel. Let's get started.
I'd like to welcome everybody. We have a very interesting paper to discuss today on diastolic function in a rat model that is seen in humans, and it's got many details of mechanisms. And I'd like to begin with Zoltan to perhaps summarize the key points of what he found in the study.
Thank you, Mike. The rationale of the study was that despite its ever-increasing prevalence, cardiac consequence of prediabetes is unknown. Therefore, we aim to perform a comprehensive study to assess functional and molecular aspects of prediabetes in a non-genetic rodent model. So after a high-fat diet of 20 weeks and a single low dose of streptozotocin, obesity with insulin resistance and hyperleptinemia developed, but fasting glucose levels, blood pressure, and blood lipid parameters were unchanged. Lipid accumulation in the myocardium and left ventricular hypertrophy was also detected. However, fibrosis and the expression of natriuretic peptides were unchanged, and the mRNA level of beta-myosin heavy change even decreased, which is a very interesting finding since usually increased expression of beta-MHC is associated with diabetes. We also detected neuropathy and deteriorated diastolic function in prediabetes, while the systolic parameters were unchanged. We also found superoxide production was elevated in the subsarcolemmal, but not in the interfibrillar mitochondria. Another evidence on the oxidative nitrosity stress was that increased nitrotyrosine signal was detected in the myocardium. Prediabetes also affected other cellular processes, decreased phosphorylation of phospholamban, decreased expression of BNIP3, and elevated expression of mitofusin 2 was detected in the heart, indicating that calcium handling, mitophagy, and mitochondrial dynamics might have also been disturbed. Although we expected, expression of heat shock proteins and common markers of apoptosis and autophagy were unaffected in prediabetes. So in summary, we found that cardiac function deteriorates in prediabetes and that these changes are results of disturbances in multiple cellular processes, including mitochondrial oxidative stress, disturbed expression of contractile proteins, disturbed calcium handling, and possibly disturbed mitochondrial dynamics.
Hamel, what comes to mind in what you saw in their study today?
Zoltan, I just want to congratulate you on a very nice study. This is sort of an area we're interested in, and we're starting to sort of develop some type 2 diabetic models, and this becomes a nice model thing. One of the things that came to mind is it's not a traditional way of inducing diabetes, and we get a lot of pushback when we try to publish papers where you use a mixed model of high-fat diet and streptozotocin injection. So could you speak a little bit about why you decided to choose this particular model rather than a genetic background kind of issue that a lot of people use?
This is a very good question. I believe that the high-fat diet in itself is not enough, because even in our case, 40% fat was not enough to induce a hyperlipidemia. So adding streptozotocin definitely helps with developing the diabetes or prediabetes in all of the models.
I agree. I mean, I think one of the important things here is if we're trying to model a clinical disease that's a prevalent problem, you know, most diabetics have a lot of these features that you see in the model that you describe, right? They're obese, they're eating high fatty foods. The interesting thing that I found in one of your characterization figures was the fact that if you give them insulin, they respond to insulin, which is what type 2 diabetics do. You know, they're hyperinsulinemic, but if you give them a boost of insulin, their blood glucoses go down. So I think it's a very good clinical representative model that I think others don't really recapitulate very well. So it's good.
I agree with your point of view, but there's always a caveat that the lipid metabolism of the rodents are completely different from that of the primates. So I believe that no perfect rodent model will ever be developed. Therefore, we aim towards more of large animal studies. For example, we started pig studies recently.
I agree. I think the rodent handles lipids very differently. You have to have some sort of genetic mutation to get atherosclerosis, whereas large models like pigs and rabbits, potentially, you may not have to do that. Turning to the mechanistic endpoints that you sort of looked at, one of the things that I find very interesting in a heart, we do a lot of electron microscopy in the laboratory. I mean, it's an amazingly beautiful looking cell, right? And there's these mitochondria that exist at the cell surface, and there's these mitochondria that exist sort of internally in a myocyte. And they look very different, and they seem to function very different. And so you've sort of hit upon that in this model. So could you go a little bit more into detail about what are some differences you saw between the subsarcolemmal mitochondria and the interfibrillary mitochondria?
Yes, morphology, protein composition, and enzymatic activities are very distinctive between interfibrillar and subsarcolemmal mitochondria. However, in our case, we didn't even see huge differences in enzymatic activities between the prediabetic and control animals, except that superoxide production in the subsarcolemmal fraction was elevated, especially after adding rotenone. It indicates that probably the complex 1 or the upstream dehydrogenases act differently between the interfibrillar and the subsarcolemmal mitochondria. And it's very interesting that, for example, in papers with type 1 diabetes models, predominantly interfibrillar mitochondria are damaged, while in papers with type 2 diabetes models, subsarcolemmal mitochondria are predominantly affected.
Based on that data set, in terms of a timing scheme of how this model develops, do you think it's all oxidant stress that starts at the subsarcolemmal mitochondria that then ultimately pushes that heart to dysfunction?
We believe that the mitochondrial oxidative stress is in the center of the changes we observed. But we also believe that the prediabetes, the phenotype of prediabetes, is multifunctional. So more than the mitochondria, the calcium handling is also affected. And we believe that they are interconnected. For example, if the circa are oxidized, then their function is definitely changed. And in our system, phospholamban phosphorylation was decreased in prediabetes. That really means that the calcium handling is disturbed.
There's a lot of sort of chatter in the alternative world in terms of medications to take antioxidants, to, you know, eat a lot of blueberries and strawberries for type 2 diabetics. Do you think there's some truth to that based on some of the things you're seeing here?
Antioxidant treatments are proposed for a very long time now, but so far nothing has made into clinics, and I don't think it's a coincidence. A low level of oxidant level is necessary even for normal function, and I don't believe that just taking drastic measures would be the solution in the prediabetic diastolic dysfunction we detected.
So turning back to that idea of the diastolic dysfunction, it's, you know, this is sort of the holy grail of where people are headed. One of the big interests is this heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, where you have diastolic dysfunction. So I guess one of the things that was curious in this paper is there's no fibrosis, and typically you associate this diastolic dysfunction with a fibrotic phenotype. So where do you think that mild diastolic dysfunction is coming from?
We believe that the decrease in the expression of beta myosin heavy chain is really interesting finding. So there are papers showing that mutation of beta MHC genes result in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, especially in the ventricular part of the heart. We believe that this might be one of the backgrounds. And the other one is that we detected lipid accumulation in the heart as well. It might be a general phenomenon after metabolic and protein expression changes in prediabetes.
So how long do you think you'd have to push this model to get full-blown diabetes, type 2 diabetes?
I don't think they will ever be diabetic.
You don't think? I mean, no. Even if you let them go a year out with the high-fat diet and the single injection?
Well, they are really resistant to being diabetic. So we saw the mildly increased fasting blood glucose. So it was about 7 millimolar, and it never budged. We don't believe that the rodents are very sensitive to dietary modulation of the fasting blood glucose levels.
You know, a lot of people are interested in genetic models and transgenes and knockouts. Do you think this is exportable to a mouse model potentially?
Yes, we are trying right now this aspect, and we assess that the diet-induced model of diabetes with streptozotocin is feasible in mice. But of course, mm-hmm. we cannot perform the same experiments in mice as in rats.
Pamela, what do you think the impact of the study is?
I think the impact of this is really pushing outside the comfort zone of what people are comfortable with diabetic models. I think experimenting with new ways to induce type 2 diabetes that really represent the clinical endpoint is really what's going to advance the therapeutic approaches that we have for diabetes. Most people do these types of models in young animals, but I think still the epidemic is in the middle-aged and the older populations. And I think the models that we're trying to develop, if we could push them into a double-hit model with aging, type 2 diabetes, using these types of approaches with diet and pushing the pancreatic beta cell toxicity, I think we're going to see a lot more impact in terms of therapeutic development.
And in terms of long-term impact, it looks like this study has a tremendous amount of information that can be looked at for how a metabolic defect causes selective effects on certain populations of mitochondria that go on to cause cardiac dysfunction. And I think there's an immense amount of detail in the study that can be looked at in future research. I want to very much thank you, Zoltan and Hamill, for a wonderful discussion of this tremendously interesting paper.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology podcast. For more podcasts like this, visit us online at ajpheart.physiology.org. Thank you.